By the time we reached the year 2029, the absolute most critical guarantor of European physical security, it wasn't a sprawling military base in Germany.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't a treaty signed in Geneva, and it wasn't even the Pentagon. It was incredibly a highly fortified billion-dollar lithium processing plant in Ontario, Canada.
Yeah, which is just wild to think about. That single facility basically encapsulated the entire global realignment.
It really did. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are cracking open Dossier Trump 2015 to 2029, Appendix C, Europe, Canada, and the New World Order. And the mission today is to completely reframe how you look at the recent past.
Right.
Because if you look at the period between 2015 and 2029, it is just so easy to keep the camera zoomed in entirely on the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the institutional tension, the protectionism, the polarization, it takes up all the oxygen in the room.
It completely dominates the historical memory.
Mm-hmm.
We naturally gravitate toward the loudest disruptions.
Right.
But stepping back into the macro geopolitical view, that single camera angle completely misses the actual structural earthquake. The dossier's core premise is that the most enduring long-term geopolitical legacy of the Trump era had very little to do with domestic American policy.
Exactly.
The true legacy is how Europe and Canada reacted to that era by architecting an entirely new 21st century strategic alliance.
They quietly built this parallel world order while everyone else was distracted by the daily news cycle. Now, before we pull the thread on how they actually pulled this off, let's establish the ground rules for today's deep dive, because we are dealing with recent, highly charged political history, specifically the era defined by the Trump effect.
Yeah, that's an important point to clarify up front. Our role as your guides to this dossier is strictly analytical. Mm. We maintain absolute neutrality. We are not evaluating this era through a left-wing or right-wing lens, nor are we, you know, endorsing or condemning any political figures or platforms that pop up in the source material.
Yeah, we're just reading the data.
Exactly. We are here to impartially unpack the documented shifts in international relations, the macroeconomic realignments, and that systemic cause and effect that occurred across Europe and North America during this specific 14-year window.
Okay, so let's unpack the foundational shift here. Think about the global security architecture like an old, massive apartment building. For 70 years, Europe had this giant, incredibly strong roommate living in the penthouse, the United States.
A very heavily armed roommate.
Right, a heavily armed roommate who always handled the building's security. They paid the alarm bill, they kept the neighborhood threats at bay. And Europe, well, they never really had to think about the locks on the doors.
No, they didn't.
Then, around 2015, that roommate suddenly starts floating the idea of changing the locks. Or making everyone else pay, like exorbitant surge pricing for the alarm system. You don't just sit on the couch and hope for the best. You start looking across the street at your quiet, responsible, heavily resourced neighbor.
It's a great analogy. To understand the sheer panic of that realization, we have to look at the baseline that existed before 2015. The dossier refers to it as the transatlantic constant.
It's constant, yeah.
This was the absolute bedrock of global stability since the end of the Second World War. The fundamental, practically unquestioned assumption in Brussels, Berlin, and Paris was that the United States would unconditionally guarantee European security.
It was the ultimate geopolitical safety net. And it's crucial to remember this was never really a partisan issue in Washington.
Not at all.
For seven decades, regardless of whether a Republican or Democrat was in the Oval Office, the grand strategy remained identical. The U.S. provided the nuclear and conventional umbrella, and Europe stood safely underneath it, which basically allowed them to focus their capital on social safety nets and economic integration rather than massive standing armies.
Right. And then the Trump effect enters the historical record around 2015. The dossier notes this as the precise moment when serious existential doubt infected the European consciousness. Questions that had only ever been debated as, you know, abstract theoretical thought experiments in international relations seminars suddenly morphed into immediate tangible panic in the halls of European defense ministries.
Okay, wait, I have to push back on this timeline a little bit.
Sure.
Are we really saying Europe was entirely naive until 2015? I mean, look at France. The Gaullist tradition has been shouting about European strategic independence since the 1960s. They literally pulled out of NATO's integrated military command for decades.
They did, yes.
And the UK and the US had massive friction with Europe over the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So why was 2015 the sudden catastrophic shock to the system?
It's a fair question. The friction you're describing, like in 2003 or with De Gaulle, That was mostly diplomatic and ideological. The 2015 shift was mechanical and transactional.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
Well, French calls for autonomy in the 1960s were about prestige and influence within the alliance.
Yeah.
The Trump effect was entirely different because it weaponized the foundational guarantee itself.
Oh, I see.
The rhetoric emerging from the U.S. directly tied American domestic election outcomes to European physical security. It introduced a transactional metric to a relationship that had previously been viewed as an unbreakable blood pact.
Oh, wow. So it turned the nuclear umbrella into a subscription service that could be canceled at any moment.
Precisely. That is exactly it. The realization wasn't a sudden change in European ideology. It was a stark realization of profound physical vulnerability.
Right.
The questions became really urgent. What if Article 5 of NATO isn't an automatic trigger? What if the U.S. prioritizes short-term economic leverage over historic democratic alliances? When the defense of Warsaw or the Baltics theoretically hinges on, like, a few thousand swing voters in the American Midwest, the psychological shift in Europe is violent and immediate.
Which triggers the phenomenon the dossier calls the European awakening. And, I mean, reading through this section, it's less of an awakening and more of a cold sweat panic attack.
That's a good way to put it.
Because between 2015 and 2029, Europe undergoes this massive internal pivot. They realize they need strategic autonomy.
Yes. Strategic autonomy is the central operational doctrine of this entire era. It meant Europe recognized a glaring need for immediate self-sufficiency across five interwoven vectors: defense, energy, industry, technology, and strategic decision making.
But, you know, for you listening, you don't just declare strategic autonomy on a Tuesday and have an independent continent on a Wednesday, right?
If only it were that easy.
Right. So the dossier outlines three specific compounding shocks accelerators that force this theoretical desire into rapid, messy reality.
Yeah. And the first accelerator was the persistent public doubt regarding NATO funding and the American commitment. It degraded the psychological certainty of the alliance over years.
Right.
The second accelerator was the COVID-19 pandemic, which acted as a brutal stress test for globalization.
Yeah, and we tend to think of the pandemic in epidemiological terms, but the dossier focuses purely on the supply chain mechanics. Because Europe suddenly realized that outsourcing the manufacturing of basic medical supplies, active pharmaceutical ingredients, and critical industrial components to distant, potentially adversarial nations, that was a catastrophic vulnerability.
Huge.
I mean, you can't fight a crisis if your cargo ships are suddenly held up by foreign export controls.
The pandemic proved that just in time, global logistics work beautifully in peacetime and collapse instantly under pressure. But the ultimate accelerator, the event that truly crystallized the European awakening, was the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, this is where the abstract theories of vulnerability turn into literal tanks crossing a sovereign border a few hundred miles from European capitals.
It shattered the post-Cold War illusion that large-scale conventional land war was permanently obsolete in Europe. It wasn't just a political crisis, it was an industrial one.
Right.
Europe rapidly realized they lacked a manufacturing base to even supply basic artillery shells for a sustained kinetic conflict, let alone secure their own borders without massive American logistical support.
So put yourself in the shoes of a European policy planner at this moment. Your traditional military umbrella is acting wildly unpredictable. Your global supply chains for microchips and medicine are completely broken. And there is a high-intensity land war raging on your eastern flank.
It's a nightmare scenario.
It is. You realize you need to build an independent defense industry, transition your entire energy grid away from Russian gas, and secure your tech sector. But you look around and realize you don't have the raw materials, the geographic scale, or the energy independence to actually do any of this on your own.
And that right there is the macroeconomic friction at the heart of the dossier. You can shift your political mindset overnight, but you cannot legislate a lithium mine into existence on a continent that lacks the geography for it.
Yeah, geology doesn't care about your policy goals.
Exactly. The urgent requirement for natural resources, political stability, and immense industrial scale forced Europe to look outward. They needed a highly specific, bespoke partnership.
They needed a partner with the resources of a superpower, but the predictability of a Swiss bank. And they found it just north of their old ally. Enter Canada.
Yeah, the elevation of Canada's geopolitical status is one of the most fascinating systemic shifts in the entire dossier. Canada transitioned from being a friendly, secondary economic player to an absolutely non-negotiable strategic anchor for the European continent.
And the dossier provides a literal checklist of traits that made Canada the obvious choice. And it starts with the most boring, but perhaps most crucial, element. extreme political stability, and a strong rule of law.
We really cannot overstate the macroeconomic value of predictability. If Europe is going to invest hundreds of billions of euros to fundamentally rewire its energy grids and defense supply chains for the next 50 years, they cannot partner with a nation where the overarching foreign policy might invert every 4 years.
Right, because that's what was happening with the U.S.
Exactly. Capital expenditure on that scale requires multi-decade legislative certainty. Canada provided an ironclad rule of law and shared democratic values. They essentially spoke the same diplomatic and regulatory language as Brussels.
Okay, so the political alignment is the foundation, but the actual house is built on raw materials. Because as Europe scrambled to untangle its energy grid from Russia and simultaneously fuel a massive green transition, Canada was basically sitting on a practically unparalleled geological lottery ticket.
It really was. The physical assets Canada offered solved multiple European crises simultaneously. For traditional energy diversification, you know, keeping the lights on and factories running while Russian pipelines were shut off, Canada possessed vast accessible reserves of natural gas, oil, hydropower, and uranium.
But the real leverage, the absolute strategic gold mine, was in the critical minerals required for the green and technological transition.
Yes, the critical minerals.
I mean, you want to build millions of electric vehicles. You want offshore wind turbines. You want advanced drone technology and autonomous defense systems. You need lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper, and rare earth metals. And Canada has them in massive, geographically secure quantities.
Think about the global geopolitical market during this era as a highly volatile stock exchange. The United States was acting like a high-risk, high-reward tech stock. You might get incredible innovation and massive returns, but the leadership is erratic, the swings are wild, and you could face a sudden catastrophic policy reversal.
Right. And Canada. Canada is the ultimate blue-chip dividend stock. It's not flashy, it doesn't make the front page every day, but it is steady, highly regulated, completely predictable, and it just so happens to own the physical infrastructure required to build the future.
That predictability is the core mechanism that allowed the alliance to flourish. Building a transcontinental supply chain for critical defense materials, say mining cobalt in Quebec, processing it and integrating it into European aerospace manufacturing, that takes a decade of planning and flawless execution.
Yeah.
And a lot of money.
A ton of money. And you can only execute that if you trust the handshake won't be withdrawn due to a sudden tariff dispute or domestic political theater.
This economic and resource pairing was perfectly timed, because as the dossier moves into the post-2022 landscape, the very definition of the word security fundamentally shifts. We aren't just talking about securing favorable trade balances anymore. We are back to the primal definition of security. Literal physical survival in the face of kinetic war.
Right. The war in Ukraine forced a brutal recalculation of risk. Energy dependence on a hostile power wasn't just an economic disadvantage. It was identified as an acute life-or-death vulnerability that could freeze populations and shut down defense manufacturing in a matter of weeks.
Which forced unprecedented capital into the system. Historic spikes in funding for ammunition production lines, cybersecurity infrastructure, and massive hardened military logistics hubs. But this brings us to a concept the dossier calls the NATO paradox. And I need you to walk me through this, because on the surface, it feels completely contradictory. It does. The NATO paradox describes a period where the alliance became simultaneously vastly more capable and deeply more uncertain.
So let me make sure I have this straight. On one hand, Europe is finally writing the checks. They're meeting and exceeding their defense spending targets. Finland and Sweden, two highly advanced, strategically vital militaries, abandoned decades of neutrality to join the alliance.
Right.
So on paper, the European continent's military capability is surging to heights not seen since the peak of the Cold War. The alliance is undeniably stronger.
Yes, the physical capabilities and the geographic footprint expanded significantly. But the deep uncertainty remained because the core underlying architecture of the alliance, the high-end intelligence gathering, the complex command and control structures, the strategic airlift capabilities, and ultimately the nuclear deterrent, all of that was still tethered to the political whims of Washington.
I see. So it's like Europe is paying premium prices for a state-of-the-art broadcast tower, but the microphone is still sitting on a desk in the Oval Office.
That's a perfect way to look at it.
What good is a massive surge in European military spending if the ultimate deployment and command structure can be frozen by American domestic polarization?
Exactly. And this paradox birthed the dual-track strategy. The new European doctrine wasn't an abandonment of NATO. It was a synthesis. Strong NATO and stronger European autonomy. they aimed to build a robust European pillar within the alliance that could, if absolutely necessary, function independently of American high command.
So they were building their own emergency exit.
Yes.
But sustaining a massive parallel military-industrial complex requires an economy that is virtually bulletproof. You cannot project military strength if your adversaries can cripple your economy by simply choking off the supply of rare earth magnets or active pharmaceutical ingredients.
This realization forced a total ground-up rewrite of global trade architecture. The year spanning 2018 to 2029 basically marked the end of the hyper-globalization era and the beginning of the friend-shoring era.
Friend-shoring, near-shoring, supply chain resilience. I mean, for decades, the entire global economy was governed by a single ruthless metric: cost optimization. Yeah.
The only question corporations asked was, where can we manufacture this product for the absolute lowest possible price? And the answer was almost universally in Asia.
But the dual shocks of the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict prove that cost optimization is entirely useless if you lack supply security. The global economy shifted its primary metric from what's cheapest to what's safest.
So if you are a regular person listening to this and you're buying a phone or a car during this period, how does friendshoring actually impact you?
Well, let's look at the macroeconomic friction here. Friendshoring sounds very cooperative and pleasant, but in practice, it is fundamentally inflationary for the consumer.
Right.
You are purposefully choosing to build supply chains in jurisdictions with higher labor costs, stricter environmental regulations, and higher taxes, simply to ensure those supply chains are physically located within aligned democracies.
It is a massive capital expenditure. Exactly. Corporations and governments had to absorb the immense upfront costs of moving sophisticated manufacturing out of adversarial nations and into allied ones. The goal was to build closed-loop supply chains to prevent economic blackmail.
Which completely changes the DNA of the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA. The dossier spends a lot of time analyzing how this specific treaty evolved.
It did. Originally, CETA was drafted under the old paradigm. It's a traditional free trade agreement designed to lower tariffs, ease regulatory barriers, and boost corporate profit margins by increasing the flow of goods across the Atlantic.
Just standard trade stuff.
Right. But as the geopolitical climate darkened, CETA mutated.
But how does a trade pact mutate into a security document? What are the actual mechanics of that shift?
It mutated through strategic implementation. CETA became the legal framework that allowed friendshoring to actually happen at scale. It facilitated mutual recognition of standards, which meant a defense component manufactured in Ontario could be immediately integrated into a European aerospace system without redundant testing.
Oh, that speeds things up immensely.
Exactly. It included mechanisms to protect cross-border investments in critical infrastructure from foreign state-owned enterprises. It essentially created a legally binding, secure economic perimeter around Europe and Canada.
So they built a fortress, but they built it out of trade regulations instead of bricks.
Exactly.
But securing physical supply chains, you know, the lithium, the microchips, the artillery shells, that is really only half the battle. Because the dossier reveals that the most complex terrain where this alliance had to operate wasn't a physical ocean, it was the digital realm.
Yes. This is the pursuit of digital sovereignty. If the 20th century was defined by control over physical choke points like the Suez Canal or the Strait of Hormuz, the 21st century is defined by control over digital infrastructure and data flows.
Right.
And Europe was facing an existential crisis, the dossier terms the big tech problem.
Yeah. Europe looked at the global digital landscape and realized they were trapped in a vice. On one side, you have the massive American tech monopolies. These entities were operating in a largely unregulated, highly aggressive commercial environment, accumulating vast amounts of European citizen data with very little oversight.
And on the other side?
Right. On the other side, you have the Chinese tech ecosystem, which is deeply integrated with a state-controlled authoritarian surveillance apparatus.
European policymakers recognize that relying on either system meant forfeiting fundamental control over their own future. They did not want their digital architecture dictated by Silicon Valley venture capital, nor did they want it compromised by Beijing's state security laws.
No.
They needed to control their own cloud infrastructure, their semiconductor manufacturing, and most importantly, the development of artificial intelligence.
But here is the stark reality. Europe is a regulatory superpower, but it is not historically a rapid innovation superpower.
No, it's not.
You can write the strictest, most comprehensive tech laws in the world, like the GDPR or the AI Act, but if you don't actually own the companies building the cutting-edge AI models, you are just writing rules for a game you aren't playing.
Exactly. Regulation without innovation leads to stagnation. If Europe only acted as the strict referee, they would inevitably fall behind economically and technologically. This is precisely where the alliance with Canada provided the missing piece of the puzzle.
Because Canada had quietly built itself into an absolute powerhouse in the AI sector.
It really had. With world-class research hubs in Toronto and Montreal, pioneered by figures like Geoffrey Hinton and Yoshua Bengio, Canada possessed the deep talent pool and the agile, innovative startup ecosystem that Europe desperately lacked.
Let's use a tangible analogy to explain how these two systems integrated, because it's pretty brilliant. Think of the AI revolution like building a next-generation nuclear reactor.
Okay.
Canada is providing the highly volatile, incredibly powerful, enriched uranium, the rapid innovation, the bleeding-edge machine learning algorithms, the raw computational breakthroughs.
Right. But raw uranium is dangerous without containment. Europe provides the state-of-the-art control rods and the cooling systems, the ethical frameworks, the privacy regulations, and the legal guardrails. So Europe was playing the strict referee, and Canada was the star player trying out new moves.
That is exactly it. When you combine them, you produce usable, safe, and immensely powerful technology. By teaming up, they created a third way, an alternative to the American Wild West and the Chinese state-controlled model.
Let's give a concrete scenario of how this third way operates in the real world. Imagine a Canadian AI firm developing a revolutionary medical diagnostics tool. Instead of training that AI on scraped, unregulated data like a U.S. firm might, or state-surveilled data like a Chinese firm, they train it using federated, deeply anonymized European health data that fully complies with strict EU privacy laws.
Right. And why does that matter for you, the listener? Because the resulting product is a globally competitive medical AI that hospitals around the world actually trust.
Compliance, privacy, and ethical alignment are baked into the fundamental architecture of the code, not just tacked on as an afterthought. This third way dictated the invisible architecture of daily life, who writes the rules for the algorithms that approve your mortgage, filter your information, and diagnose your illnesses.
They created a tech ecosystem built on democratic values rather than pure profit extraction or state control. And that shared desire to build a sustainable, regulated future extended beyond the digital cloud and directly into the actual clouds, their shared climate goals.
The green transition was really the most capital-intensive collaborative effort of the alliance. Both Europe and Canada viewed climate change not merely as an environmental crisis, but as the primary macroeconomic opportunity of the century.
They essentially built a transatlantic green industrial complex. I mean, we are talking deep structural integration on hydrogen power development, next generation battery manufacturing, offshore wind deployment, and carbon capture technologies.
And this ties directly back to the secure supply chains of critical minerals we discussed earlier. The green transition is intensely resource heavy. You cannot build a net zero grid without unfettered access to copper and nickel.
Right. But the most geographically mind-bending aspect of their climate collaboration centers on a region that historically barely registered in global trade discussions. The Arctic frontier.
It's fascinating. The melting of the Arctic ice is an unprecedented geographic event in modern human history. Climate change is physically altering the map of the world, opening up an entirely new navigable ocean at the top of the globe.
I love this detail. It sounds like a sci-fi movie. It is wild to think about the physical geography of the Earth changing so fast that militaries and shipping conglomerates have to scramble to secure an ocean that was frozen solid a decade ago.
Yeah.
As the ice melts, a literal new ocean of trade and defense opens up. We are talking about the opening of the Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route, which can drastically cut shipping times between Asian manufacturing hubs and European ports. Hmm. It's like discovering a new Suez Canal overnight.
But an opening ocean brings staggering strategic vulnerabilities. As the ice recedes, the Arctic transforms into a highly contested geopolitical flashpoint. It offers newly accessible sea routes, vast, unexploited natural resources on the ocean floor, and a completely new theater for military posturing.
And when you look at a globe from the top down, the geography dictates the strategy. Russia has a massive Arctic coastline and immediately began militarizing it, building deep water ports, reopening Cold War radar stations, and deploying fleets of nuclear icebreakers.
And China declared itself a near Arctic state to justify pushing its influence north.
Right. So Europe, looking north at this rapidly opening frontier, realized they were facing a heavily militarized, highly aggressive competitor right on their northern roof. How does Europe project power and ensure freedom of navigation in an environment as harsh and specialized as the Arctic?
They can't. Not alone. They need a partner who actually owns the real estate, and Canada is the indispensable gatekeeper here.
Canada is suddenly the gatekeeper.
Exactly. The Canadian Arctic archipelago sits squarely across these new routes. For Europe, Canada became the ultimate security anchor in the north. The alliance had to integrate their naval capabilities, share advanced satellite surveillance, and coordinate on environmental protection to counter adversarial encroachment.
It is the ultimate test of the EU-Canada alliance. It's where environmental policy, military defense, and raw economics physically collide in the freezing water. Managing that requires a foundation much deeper than a standard free trade agreement.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most vital analytical section of the dossier, the preservation of shared democratic values as a macroeconomic moat.
Right, because treaties can be broken, trade agreements can be renegotiated. But to face a challenge as massive as the changing Arctic or the rise of AI, you need a deep structural alliance that spans decades and that requires an ideological bedrock.
The period between 2015 and 2029 was marked by significant democratic backsliding globally. Authoritarian systems were gaining not just military power, but immense economic and technological influence. Europe and Canada recognized that preserving the core tenets of their societies, the rule of law, absolute press freedom, human rights, and multilateral cooperation, was no longer just a moral imperative. It was a matter of strategic survival.
If they didn't actively interlock their economies and defense structures to defend the democratic model, they risked being marginalized, picked off one by one by larger state-directed economies.
The dossier actually concludes by wargaming this dynamic, projecting three distinct scenarios for how this Euro-Canadian alliance might evolve between the years 2030 and 2050.
I want to walk through these because as we break them down, I want you listening to consider which of these trajectories feels most reflective of the world we are currently living in right now.
Okay, so scenario A is categorized as the hyper-integrated alliance. In this future, the shocks of the 2020s lead to a profound, almost total integration across all critical sectors. We are talking about fundamentally linked energy grids across the Atlantic, completely unified tech regulations that dictate global standards, joint military procurement where European and Canadian forces operate indistinguishably, and frictionless high-volume trade.
They operate as a singular, massive democratic fortress.
Exactly. Then there's scenario B, multipolar cooperation. This is a more nuanced, complex web. In this world, the global temperature cools slightly. Europe maintains its deep bond with Canada, but it actively balances relationships across a multipolar world. It strikes targeted deals with the U.S., India, Japan, and perhaps even a stabilized China.
But critically, the dossier asserts that even in this diffuse multipolar web, Canada remains Europe's most stable, non-negotiable core partner. They are the anchor that allows Europe to safely engage with the rest of the volatile world.
Yes. And finally, we have scenario C. Strategic fragmentation. This is the darkest trajectory.
Yeah, this one is grim.
In scenario C, the global order entirely fractures. We see a hard decoupling of the global economy into deeply hostile, deeply disconnected blocks. International supply chains break down completely under the weight of tariffs, kinetic conflicts, and cyber warfare.
In this fragmented zero-sum world, Europe and Canada are forced into absolute mutual dependence. It is no longer an alliance of opportunity or optimization. It is a claustrophobic alliance of pure survival. They have to rely on each other because there is literally no one else left to trust.
Hyperintegration, multipolar balancing, or grim fragmentation. What is truly remarkable about the dossier's analysis is that its ultimate conclusion remains static regardless of which future actually materializes.
The structural realities, the raw materials, the technological synergy, the geographic necessities of the Arctic, and the shared democratic DNA ensure that Canada's role as Europe's essential partner is permanently locked in. The die was cast during those 14 years of disruption.
If we synthesize this entire deep dive, it reveals a profound truth about geopolitical architecture. Global relationships are incredibly dynamic. The certainty of one era is often the vulnerability of the next.
When the transatlantic security blanket that defined the entire 20th century began to fray, it didn't just leave Europe out in the cold to freeze. It catalyzed a profound, necessary evolution. The ultimate legacy of the Trump era wasn't just the polarization or the domestic American turbulence. The legacy is that it forced Europe and Canada to look past Washington and discover they were natural, perfect allies.
Together, they architected a democratic, economically open, and tech-ambitious bloc that provided a viable alternative to the rest of the world. They successfully shifted the geopolitical center of gravity.
Which leaves us with the dossier's final provocative question, a thought for you to carry with you after this deep dive concludes. We know what the transatlantic relationship between Europe and the United States achieved in the 20th century. It built the modern world.
It did.
The question is, can the Euro-Canadian cooperation of the 21st century grow into what the transatlantic relationship was in the 20th century? Think about the invisible architecture of your daily life. The privacy of the data on your phone, the origin of the lithium in your car battery, the security protocols guarding your energy grid. How much of that is now dictated by a world where the center of strategic gravity permanently shifted north?
It really forces a complete reevaluation of the global map.
It really does. Well, that comprehensively wraps up our analysis of Appendix C. But our journey through this massive document is far from over, because next time we are diving straight into the fire. We are cracking open Appendix D, the Trump scorecard.
And that will require a rigorously data-driven approach.
Absolutely. We're putting aside the speeches, the rhetoric, and the political theater. We're going to look purely at the cold, hard macroeconomic data from 2015 to 2029. What was promised? What was actually executed? What were the measurable physical results on the ground? And perhaps most fascinatingly, what were the wild, catastrophic, or incredibly lucrative, unintended consequences that absolutely no one saw coming? You won't want to miss it.